up for the lecture. You'll see that I give a little bit of extra spacing for passage number one, number A, focus passage number A. And one of the reasons is that I think if you look at this and use it as a way of trying to gauge yourself about how you're progressing in your quest to be able to read this difficult literature, difficult and challenging literature, I think you will find that there's a crucial line here that, as I would say, separates the sheep from the goats, or separates the apples from the oranges. And I signal it for you in footnote one, the key word for today, krisis, which I define as judgment, crisis. And in fact, the English word crisis is derived from krisis. And this is an abstract noun that's derived from krino in the sense of judge, distinguish, make distinctions. And it's precisely the making of distinctions between apples and oranges. Or as I heard about one incident, somebody's in therapy and it's job related, and so the therapist asks the patient, tell me more about your job. And he says, basically, it's apples coming down a chute, and I have to put the larger ones to the left and the smaller ones to the right. And so the therapist says, well, but that looks like a fairly easy thing to do, a pretty easy job. And he says, oh, doctor, but the decisions. And the decisions do come almost every verse in what you're reading. And you notice that when you're reading the Odyssey, the decision-making has simply accelerated, where you have to make a decision whether what you're reading out of the text, not into the text, what you're reading out of the text is the quote-unquote right meaning. Do I have it right? Am I going to be successful in writing essays about this? And in fact, we did try this particular passage in those web assignments just to see what your initial reaction was. And it's not that I'm saying you had the wrong answer if you simply said, in interpreting this particular focus passage A, oh well, Odysseus tells you what it means, so don't bother me. Odysseus says, I'm the talking eagle, and this is what it means, period. Let's read it again and do yet another close reading, and maybe I can weave some further perspectives into our reading. And it's not that I'm saying what you said, if you said that, was wrong. It's just that it may be a trick where you're tricked into reading the surface meaning and then you miss the underneath the surface meaning. And as I start this reading, I dedicate this reading to David Goldenheim. I decided to dedicate each lecture to somebody who made a particularly incisive remark over the week. And David happened to be attending the film that I was showing last night, and he just instantly read the whole thing with one comment on email, which I hope you do check. So this is for you, David. Listen then to a dream that I have had and interpret it for me, if you can. Now, let's set up the context. This is Penelope. He's speaking to the disguised person who is really Odysseus, her long, long husband, whom she hasn't seen for 20 years. And the question is, what is Penelope really wanting from this stranger? Has she recognized the stranger already? Why is she asking the stranger to interpret a dream? And then she goes on to narrate her dream that she has 20 geese. Well, what does 20 suggest to us? Odysseus has been away. One for each year that Odysseus has been away. So it's like saying, this will mean nothing to anybody else, but this will mean something very special to you if you're Odysseus, right? So it's already coding. And they eat mash out of the trough, and of which I'm exceedingly fond. Now, this can't be the suitors, right? Because she doesn't like the suitors, does she? She says she's fond of them. I dreamed that a great eagle came swooping down from a mountain and dug his curved beak into the neck of each of them till he killed them all. Presently he soared off into the sky and left them lying dead about the yard. Whereupon I wept in my room till all my maids gathered round me, so piteously was I grieving because the eagle had killed my geese. Then he came back again and, perching on a projecting rafter, spoke to me with human voice. I just love this. This is the only time you'll ever see something like this in archaic Greek literature. I defy you to see another situation where an omen stops being an omen and says, well, actually, I signify such and such. It's a little bit like Monty Python. There's that sketch about the village idiot where the village idiot is making everybody laugh and making faces. And then the moment the village idiot thinks that the camera is looking only at him and there's nobody for him to be a village idiot to, he then starts explaining his social function in the society, you know. So anyway, here's the eagle saying, well, here's what I signify. But listen, this is still Penelope speaking in a context, right? And this is still Penelope speaking to somebody who hasn't identified himself, and somebody she may or may not know, I'm not telling you, she may or may not know that is her long-lost husband of 20 years ago. So here's what the talking eagle says. But remember, this is not the mainframe narrative. This is a narrative within a narrative, and in fact, it's a quotation within that. Be of good courage, daughter of Ikarios. This is no dream, but a vision of good omen that shall surely come to pass. The geese are the suitors. It's just the kind of thing you want, you know, when you want a sort of a monarch notes explanation of something. This is a monarch notes explanation. The geese are the suitors. And I'm no longer an eagle. Well, why not? Because he's talking, right? I'm no longer an eagle, but your own husband, who am come back to you and who will bring these suitors to a disgraceful end. Now you're saying to yourself, but he is speaking this truth because I know, I've read the whole Odyssey. This is just like all the very good essays I got where, remember Achilles is saying in Iliad, scroll 9, line 413, I have a choice between Nostos and Kleos. And some of you pointed out to me, well, look, he hasn't made up his mind at that specific moment. You only know that Achilles makes the choice of Kleos, eternal glory by way of the Iliad, versus Nostos, which would not work for him, when you read the whole Iliad, right? You don't know it at that precise moment, and maybe he doesn't know it at that precise moment. You see how my close reading today, it is almost like an Ainos, remember that word, A-I-N-O-S, a coded message with a surface meaning and an underneath the surface meaning. It's really an Ainos for the whole course, isn't it? Where at any given moment that you're reading something, it may mean one thing in that context, but when you see the overall context, you realize what the deeper meaning is. Isn't it also an Ainos for the concept of the hero? Everything we've learned about so far, which is that the hero is dynamic, not static. At any given freeze frame where you see a hero and what the hero is doing, you can't say this is the hero because the hero's in motion. And you can't pin the hero down until what point? Death. I gave away the whole lecture. So, end of quote. And again, you can say, well, this is exactly what will happen in the Odyssey, so this is true. I say it's true, but it's still the surface truth. And why does the Odyssey go to such length and going on for quite a few more verses? And why all the elaborations and the embroideries, if that's all there is to it? Well, let me not answer my question prematurely. Let's go on. On this I woke. So then she wakes up. Now it's her reality, right? So now she can sort of interpret for herself what this dream means. And she is asking the stranger to interpret the dream for her. Now you could always say, did she really have this dream or did she make it up? You could say so many. From this I awoke, and when I looked out, I saw my geese at the trough eating their mash as usual. They're just going peck peck, and it's as if nothing happened. They're still there. What was the purpose of crying uncontrollably and feeling so empathetic about them? And then Odysseus, the disguised Odysseus, and let's say she doesn't know yet who this person is, rises to the challenge and interprets. So she says, "This dream, lady," replied Odysseus, "can admit but of one interpretation." "Well, if there's only one interpretation, then maybe we should stop reading. But let's go on. For had not Odysseus himself told you how it shall be fulfilled, the death of the suitors is portended, and not one single one of them will escape." "Only one interpretation? Well, could I ask you a question, which is, many of you must have heard that song, 'I've grown accustomed to her face.' It's like breathing out and breathing in, et cetera, et cetera. And, okay, so let me grant you that she doesn't like the suitors. She doesn't like these people who have been paying all this attention to her for 20 years. Okay? And then suddenly her husband comes back after 20 years, no explanation. Right? And then, okay, we're several steps removed from quote-unquote reality, but the husband says, 'I'm your husband, be happy. I just came back.' There is that problem of the way Russian formalists describe it, defamiliarization, where it's been 20 years that she hasn't known him, and all she has is the memories of 20 years plus ago. Okay? And so in a sense, the geese are familiar to her, the eagle is suddenly strange to her and unfamiliar. That's not saying that she really prefers the geese to the eagle. I'm just saying that this is a beautiful way to explore a woman's emotions and how a woman would feel in this particular situation, which the disguised Odysseus confronts her with. So look at her answer. Wow, what an answer. "Stranger, dreams are very curious and unaccountable things, and they do not by any means invariably come true. There are two gates through which these insubstantial fancies proceed. The one is of horn and the other ivory. Those that come through the gate of ivory are fatuous," in other words, vain, inconsequential, insubstantial. "And those from the gate of horn mean something," look at this, "mean something to those that see them." In other words, I know my meaning. It was my dream, but I still ask you to interpret it. And then it goes on, "I do not think, however, that my own dream came through the gate of horn, though I and my son should be most thankful if it proves to have done so." Okay, a little bit of word game. In ancient Greek, the word for ivory is very related to a word that would mean, it's not related, but it sounds like a word that would mean to get things wrong, to be deceived, to have your mind scrambled. So that's something we wouldn't automatically know if we didn't know the ancient Greek language. That's why I'm telling you. So there's a kind of play on words in her associating ivory with false dreams. And then about true dreams, gate of horn, well, you know what that word sounds like in ancient Greek? It sounds like when you say something and it comes true. And we'll explore this kind of wording later, but the idea is you say something, you may not even intend the truth, but in the long run, the story proves that what you said was absolutely 100% true. To show you what a complex personality Penelope is, horn in those days, as also I think in much of our own metaphorical world, is an aphrodisiac. And it's no accident that we still say today vulgarism, to be horny, that has to do with making metonymic contact with aphrodisiacs, with sex stimulants. And that's also part of what Penelope is saying. So curiously, the gate of horn is also a gate of desires, of sexual desires. And that's all part of this beautiful, multi-level, rich description of a woman's feelings at, what is it, a crisis moment, a moment of crisis where you have to figure out how to interpret. Now, if anybody dares ask me, is this going to be on the exam, I will just be very sad, okay? But flip the page and look at focus passage E. And don't you dare ask me whether you're responsible for this, because you're responsible for it for life. This is good. This is one of the most beautiful pieces of poetry by somebody who happens to be the librettist of Mozart, Mozart's favorite librettist for his Italian operas, Da Ponte. And what Da Ponte is doing here is taking a very beautiful convention of Italian Renaissance poetry, which goes back even further to the troubadour poetic traditions of southern France. And if you want me to give you a sort of name for the form of what's going on here, I'll use a southern French, that is to say, Provençal word, not responsible for the word, deviner, which means a guessing song. A guessing song. And this is a song where he sings it to her, and whatever the song says means something only to her and to no one else in the whole world. And only she will understand if she loves him. And if she doesn't love him, then she won't understand. Let's look at some of the words. Voi che sapete che cosa è amore. You who know what thing love is. Donne vedete. My lady, see if I have it in my heart. Now, who is Cherubino? Cherubino is literally little cherub. And he's this adorable little boy, little adolescent, who is in love with the Countess, an older woman. And it's an unrequited love. And, you know, Italian song tradition, song culture, just loves unrequited love, just as Hungarians do. And so Cherubino, just to make it even more interesting, in Italian opera tradition,